I was just in Costa. Secular books, although maybe not as secular as you think. So I was in the jungle reading and studying and thinking. And, you know, the thing about being in the jungle, people in the jungle now have cell phones. It's a weird thing. But I'm like trying, there's a signal. Even way out in the jungle, they've built cell phone towers in different places. They've taken helicopters. So there's a signal, and there's your phone, and there's the tower. But what's missing? What would you say is missing? You have a phone. You have a signal. What? Yeah, but I can't get Bible apps to work because, no, I don't have to have electricity to use this. It's charged. It works. But I can't use Bible apps because I'm lacking what? Language. I can read it. Oh, yeah. Oh, it's amazing now. You can read and, yeah, there's a provider. I have T-Mobile, and in Costa Rica they have Claro. And so when I land, as soon as I open my phone, it goes, welcome to Costa Rica. This is your connection, and you have such and such and such and such. It's amazing flying through different countries how as soon as you land, your phone tells you, welcome to wherever, before the stewardess even says it. So I have that. But I can't use it. Why? What am I missing? Very good. Who said that? Connection. You may be in the back row, but you got the yes. And I think we can have the Bible, we can have us, we can have God, but we're often missing connection. And you know, the funny thing about the connection in the jungle is you could turn your phone like a few inches and lose the connection, turn your phone a few inches and get your connection. It's amazing the way connection works. Even in my mother-in-law's house in Pennsylvania, it was like that. You had to go put your phone at a certain point right by the window, and if you moved it, it didn't work. I mean, in the United States, I'm like, this is worse than third world. I mean, how is that? And we have competition here, you know. So anyways, connection. And so if you want to kind of understand the book of Ecclesiastes, I think this is probably one of the key ways that you can understand this book. Because Solomon, verse 1, and I believe that when it says that Solomon wrote it, I believe Solomon wrote it. There are scholars who want to dispute this. And several more times, he says it in verse 12, he was the king of Israel. He was in Jerusalem. So there's these references to Solomon. And we don't know when Solomon wrote it. It's a very big debate as to when did he actually write this book. And I think one of the reasons we have such a problem with this book is it sounds very pessimistic. And we're Americans, we're optimists, we don't like pessimism. And it's kind of weird and depressing, and it's a book that just is strange. And then you have people who, you know, we have rankings, you know, there's Romans, Galatians, and then I think if we rank the 66 books, Ecclesiastes is probably number 66 or very close to the bottom. I won't ask you if you've read it. And if you've read it, then you have more problems because it's got some weird stuff. So in the very few minutes that we have, I just want to give you kind of a little quick, this is the drone, you know, quick overview. This does not claim to be anything more than maybe something that'll get you to read it and go back and say, you know, maybe I should go look at it. Maybe there's something here for me. As you know, Paul said, 2 Timothy, all scripture is God-breathed. And it's profitable for doctrine, for instruction, correction, reproof, and righteousness. So Ecclesiastes fits. Connection. I want to mention three areas where you can find the book of Ecclesiastes telling us about connection. And right at the start of the book, when you get going, after the famous statement that you hear over and over, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Second verse. But then, what advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, and the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun just set, we saw it set. And hastening to its place, it rises again, blowing toward the south, turning toward the north. The wind continues swirling along. On its circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea. Yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. So it starts with this kind of very poetic kind of song about creation. And then it ends, chapter 12, with the words, remember your creator. And there it says, in the days of your youth. Then it has this very interesting description of age, which can give you all kinds of, that's where you read the notes, because my goodness, the Hebrew and the allusions there, scholars are not agreed, but there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. And so the book begins and ends with creation. And through the book, there's different moments when it refers, and this refrain, under the sun, under the sun, under the sun, kind of weaves through the book. And right at the front, what I just read, what advantage is there in all your work? We've just left work, and the word for work is not, it's toil. Amal is a Hebrew word that is, it's what you feel like at the last 15 minutes of work when your boss just asks you to do a whole bunch more stuff and you're just tired and you're ready to quit. It's interesting that psychologists have done studies, and I'm not going to ask for a show of hands here, but the statistics are that over 50% of people in America are unhappy at work. And every time I mention this, you'll see people nodding. Some of you like your work, some of you don't like your work, some of you put up with your work, and we all need our work, and it's a good thing to work. And we're Americans. I mean, that's what we do, is we work. But one of the great things about Ecclesiastes is it gives you a handle on the material world. I know you don't listen to Madonna, but once upon a time she sang this song called I'm a Material Girl, and this is a material world. And if there's anything about America's, we're about the material world. I mean, we export it everywhere. You can go to the furthest reaches and find a Coca-Cola can in the jungle. I mean, it's crazy what you find of America all over the world. And the book of Ecclesiastes struggles with materialism. In fact, right after what I read, you'll read Solomon talking about all his great accomplishments. He built this and he made gardens, and it's all about the material world, including women, everything that he did. And what do you do with this? And by the way, we're not real good in church. We're great at talking about the spiritual world. We're not real good at talking about the material world. Yes, we argue over evolution. That's kind of like our thing. But if God did create the material world, why is our theology of the material world not robust? We should be at the forefront. If we really believe, we'll argue till we're blue in the face about evolution, but we've lost the consequences of creation. A.W. Tozer said, the modern scientist has lost God in creation. We've lost God in the wonders of his word, like they've lost God in the wonders of his world. And one of the places we've lost God in the wonders of his world is the way the Bible celebrates creation throughout Scripture. And we'll just say this. When God chose to allow himself to be visible to us, how did he do it? With literally steak, with blood and flesh. You know, the Greek word for the word became flesh is kind of a steak word. It's very fleshy. Flesh sounds kind of fancy. But the word, when you're reading it in Greek in the book of John, it strikes you. I mean, it's something you could eat. Not that you would. God revealed himself with skin. So God obviously cared. Furthermore, the ultimate Christian ritual is what? We celebrate what? The Lord's Supper. And what do? We eat and we drink. It's a physical act. So why do we have a struggle as Christians with the material aspect? And when you think about the world of Solomon, outside of Solomon's temple, what's the chief religious outlook? Baalism, you know, the enemies of Israel, Philistines, they're nature gods. Because you lived in a world of agriculture. If you didn't produce, if your wife didn't have babies, you're toast, literally. I mean, and so the world around Israel is nature gods, it's creation gods, it's other gods of, you know, Baal is riding on the winds, and you can even find psalms that scholars tell us the Ugaritic is very similar to some of the psalms. Why are the Psalms talking about nature? It's not just because, oh, I love going and seeing the Alps. No, it's a statement against all the other nature gods, making divine. I mean, even in the New Testament, it's the same thing. All the gods, Dionysus, you know the temples to the gods in Corinth? Corinth is chock full of temples to other gods. When Paul's talking about meat offered to idols, this is what he's talking about. We've lost all that because Christianity triumphed over all that. So, you know, when I was in the jungle, I'm telling you, who taught me to see God in creation were the people of the jungle. because everything, if you have a river, there's the river tiger in the river. If you, you know, your whole world is a world of spiritual power. Every phenomenon of nature is spiritual. We have completely wiped that away. That's the triumph of Christianity. Now we just look at a mountain and see a mountain. I remember the first time I took a Kavekad person from the jungle to the ocean. They freaked out. They got back in the car, a very good believer, because the ocean is this spiritual force. And if you look at it, something can happen to you. Do you know that Ta'om in the Old Testament is like that? Do you know that the Hebrews, when they saw the ocean, they were kind of spooked? This is the world of Solomon. And the scriptures are pushing back and giving us, God did it. When the rivers go to the sea, this is God is in control of this. So we just read that and we yawn. But that's a theological upfront statement, along with remember your creator at the end of the book. God is in charge of all the processes, physically, materially, and work is part of that. And one of the verses that chapter 2 ends with, after he says, you know, I made ponds of water to irrigate a forest of growing trees. You know, I collected for myself silver and gold, and I became great and increased more than all those that preceded me. And then he kind of gets philosophical. But I hated the fruit of all my labor that I labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. Who knows whether he is wise or a fool? And then he makes his conclusion. What does a man get for all his labor and his striving? Because all his days and his tasks are painful. There is nothing better, and all the men say amen, than to eat and to drink. How many of you didn't come with supper? You're like, hope this doesn't last long because I'm hungry. And tell himself, literally, it's a hifil verb in the Hebrew, cause his soul to see good in his work. Tov. Every time God does something in Genesis 1, he goes, it's tov. And when he's all done, he says, it's like super tov. It's like Eod Tov. This Tov is like no other Tov. It is good beyond good. It defines good. Because God doesn't make junk. Cause one soul to see good in one's work, for this is from the hand of God. If you like what you're doing, do you realize that's a God thing? At work, if you like your work, that's what he says. If you like work, God is in it. Maybe if you don't like work, you need to think either why you don't like work or find work you do like. I know that might be hard, but I'm just saying it's very interesting. We don't have a theology of work. Now, that's one of the things I love about Calvinists, because they do care about the world we live in. Because, you know, Calvin in Geneva wanted people to make what they made to the glory of God. Why are Swiss watches the best in the world? Because they were Calvinists. And they said, you don't make a watch just in a junky way. You make the best possible watch because you're making it for the glory of God. And to this day, you may be a pagan in Switzerland, but you make a Swiss watch worthy of the God who gave you the technology to make it. And in a technological world, we have completely lost, even many Christians, this view. So, read Ecclesiastes. Second thing. This book talks an awful lot about human beings and how human beings get along or don't get along with each other. relationships. Connection to relationships. And one of the saddest things about the world we live in, this world of social media, this world where I won't ask what you did at supper, but how many families have, everyone has a cell phone at the table and no one's talking? And we know this to be true. And there's some people that push back against this, and I'm not saying it's wrong if you do it. But we have all these social media connections, but we've lost the human connection. And this book is all about that. It's about a technological world that's engulfing Israel. Israel is suddenly becoming great. The great moment, the greatest moment in Israel's history, David and Solomon. And he's saying, be careful. You're going to lose your relationships in the middle of all your technology. In the middle of all your building this wonderful society David and Solomon are building, we're about to lose it. Interesting. Solomon built the temple because David was told by Nathan, you're not going to build the temple. There's not a word about the temple in this book. Why? In fact, one of the weird things he says is don't let your steps, the only time he talks about the house of God, don't let your steps go often to the house of God. This is a guy whose dad, I mean, look what he did. Look at how David organizes the choirs and Solomon, I mean. But he realizes there's a danger there. And so as they're building this incredible society, this utopia. Israel thinks it's going to be on earth forever, and they're going to have this amazing. They're losing it. And then there's the people who want to go live back the way it used to be. But again, what is solid and what is not? By the way, the word Ecclesiastes in Hebrew is Kohelet. And it comes from Kahal. Kahal is like the assembly. And that's why Jerome, when he's translating the Greek text to Latin, uses ecclesia, Ecclesiastes. He just takes the Greek word and makes it into a word in the Latin. And he puts the guy who is kind of like karaoke, or he's the rapper. He's rapping. He's the guy with the microphone. He's the guy with the poetry. We translate it as the preacher. But there's no pulpit. They're not sitting in a room. He's in the streets. He's looking at dead flies in the market in a little perfume vial. And he's saying, well, that's like wisdom. And he sees the snake charmer. And he says, you know, if you don't be careful, the snake charmer is going to get bit. He sees a guy cutting with an axe. This is why we don't read the book of Ecclesiastes, because that doesn't sound very spiritual. The preacher of Ecclesiastes is not like any preacher I know. I'm standing with Huang in a museum this afternoon by appointment only. And it's interesting that her name is Beth, what is it, DeWoody? And they introduce a collection of some of her work as a wing and a prayer. And if you saw it, you would say, there's not much prayer here, and I don't know. But it says, it's an exploration of spirituality in connection to our lived experience, prayer and ritual, the natural and the supernatural, the sacred and the mundane. Why do I have to go to an art museum to hear what I ought to hear in church? Because our theology is sadly lacking in this area. So I won't get off on this too much, but we're pilgrims. And Solomon is saying, guys, we're not going to build this utopian society. It's hollow. It's hevel. It's meaningless if you just like Andy Warhol, the surface is the surface and what you see is what you see. Andy Warhol takes a Brillo pad. The first thing he did, you know, and he did the famous Campbell soup, tomato soup, but there we saw today. It was a signed copy of the first little Brillo pad. It's just, he took a thing from your kitchen. But it was he actually grew up in an Orthodox home in Pittsburgh. He had a very deep spiritual root. So the social world, how do we deal with our social world? Again, we're kind of lacking in this. If you don't believe it, why is the church back door bigger than the front door? Why do we have the revolving door where we kind of go from church to church? Well, the great thing about Protestantism, if you don't like it, you move to another church. Back in the day, you could not do this. In Roman Catholic Costa Rica, you couldn't move from church to church. You were locked into your church. Back before Luther, you had no choice. Now we can go anywhere. But we've lost something in this. Because I don't go to church to be with people I like. I go to church to be with people I don't like. Why? Because I need them in my life. Because the church isn't about being with my little social country club of spiritual nature. The church is a bunch of people just like me who have all kinds of problems. And one day I'm going to upset you and one day you're going to upset me. But if we can stay together, that's the gospel. The grace that somehow we can get past Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel and actually be something. If there's anything that speaks in today's world, is that we can get along. Jesus' prayer in John 17, that they may be one as we are one. So the final thing you see in this book as you're finishing the book. Oh, and by the way, one little thing. I can't go by this. Ecclesiastes 9:9. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which she has given you under the sun, for this is your reward in life and your toil. And if you are having trouble with work and you don't like work, well, enjoy your wife. We won't ask how many of you enjoy your wife or your husband. That's another problem. But all I can say is that 50 years, I wouldn't trade it for anything. And when I go to a restaurant to celebrate an anniversary, the waitress goes, "You've been how long?" and pulls out a pad. "Tell me, what did you do?" I'm telling you, that's how you preach. The preacher preaches. You're like, "But I don't have spiritual gifts." You have a marriage. You have children. They're preaching. Every day of your life in your neighborhood. If I go to your neighborhood, they can tell me what you're preaching or not preaching. And that's what's going to sell or not sell our faith. It's not what we do here. It's what we do outside of here that advances or slows down the advance of the gospel. So finally, the spiritual world. You know, Thomas Aquinas was the great Catholic scholastic scholar who, when Socrates comes back into Western civilization because it had been lost and is translated, it hit Judaism, it hit Catholicism like a freight train. Because, you know, I'll just oversimplify. Plato would say, "Oh, that tree, the idea behind the tree, the beauty." Socrates goes, "It's just a tree." So this, Schaeffer used to talk about the particulars and the universals, and both of them were talking. But what happened is he created this new idea in theology. Okay, they're both right. Up here, Plato's right. You know, the spiritual. Down here, Socrates is right. But in doing that, he divided the everyday life we live Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday from our Sunday life, our Wednesday night Bible study life. And so we tend to equate our spiritual life with what happens when we have devotions on Sunday. And we don't have a theology for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I remember seeing this article about one of the new churches that was putting a church at every exit in Atlanta. And it said, where's the church on Monday morning? And we could ask, where's the church on Thursday morning? That's what Ecclesiastes is all about. We can't live in the material box or the social box. Spirituality covers it all. And the thing that I'm seeing in this museum is that they have, sadly, a more Buddhist view of spirituality, and they reject us because we don't know how to pull it together. If you're an ecologist, you don't go to Christians to find a basis. You go to Buddhists. Why? Because we don't know how to put the worlds together. So as the book ends, Solomon says, again, for the final time, Hevel Hevelim, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. In addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge. He pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words and write words of truth correctly. Verse 10, verse 11 of chapter 12. The words of wise men are like goads, and masters of these connections are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. My friends, we need nails to hold us, and we need goads to correct us. And it says, all are given by one shepherd. The thing about wisdom, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Job, is it's about our everyday. And it's about what goes on in our everyday. Job is struggling with his sickness. And how many of us tonight are struggling with what's happening to other people or to us? Song of Solomon. You know, it's a very down-to-earth book about your relationship with the person of the opposite sex. Wisdom is a hard road. We're really good at the law. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. We're great at prophets. We're not so good at wisdom. And you know what? Jesus quotes Proverbs all over the place. Paul, when he's in Corinth, struggling with these pagans, because if the gospel doesn't work in Las Vegas, the gospel doesn't work. What does he do? You can see the references. He goes to Job. He goes to Proverbs. He goes to Ezekiel. The times when Israel didn't have a temple. The times when Israel's having to live like you in an everyday world. You think it's tough? I'm telling you, it was really tough to be in Babylon and keep your head. I don't think any of us have to live what they lived in Babylon. Without temple, without anything. And that's where Jesus is going. You guys think they show him the temple. Oh, look at this beautiful thing. He's like, there isn't going to be one stone left on the other. When it's all torn down, then what? He showed the way to live. In the first story, in the everyday, when everything is stripped away. And Paul does the same thing. The book of Revelation is doing the same thing. Because we have to tear down the barrier between our spiritual world, our supernatural world, and our natural world. Our natural world has become more supernatural, and our supernatural world has become more natural. And that's what Luther and Calvin fought for, against the Roman Catholic Church that isolated the church into this little ivory spiritual tower. But what about us? Can we find our connection with God in the material world around us, in the social world around us? And can we make what they said here in the art museum, the mundane, a place where God, where there's something sacred, where God is operating? One of the pieces was this amazing, it just looked like four pieces of plastic put together, but when you looked inside, you could see a faint image. And if you, the guy said, if you wear black, you can see there was an image of a person inside there. And they took mineral oil. The guy said, I don't even know how he did this, the artist. But his point was the invisible and the visible. How do we make the invisible visible? How do we have communion with God in the middle of a world that denies the God? And that's our challenge. And we don't need the movements to get us there. The Bible, 1,500 years, except for a very short period of time, is dealing with everything is against you. Moses did not have an easy time. The people of God in Babylon had it rough. But here we are today. Paul did not have an easy time. And it was not easy for Jesus. And he did not spare words for the religious establishment. So it's possible. The question is, can we learn from Paul, who has his head in Ecclesiastes and other books of wisdom, and be wise men in that way? Connection. Do you have the connection? God bless you.